Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this bi-weekly news, interviews, and commentary experience live from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, and as well as catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett and exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Again, right now we're live on Twitch. You can follow the Numbers on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, and that's Numbers with a Z. But we begin each of these shows with news stories you might have missed but should be on your radar. So without further ado, the news. Our first story comes from OPB by Lauren Drake, titled "Oregonians Are United in Concerns About Wildfires," poll finds. According to Drake, wildfires burned more than 800,000 acres in the summer of 2021. She writes, the Oregon Values and Belief Center conducted a statewide poll from June 2nd through 11th to gather Oregonians' attitudes and perceptions about wildfires in the state. Less than half the Oregonians polled approved of how wildfires are currently managed by either landowners or the government. A majority of those polled, 78%, said there should be periodic controlled burns of forests to help stave off large uncontrolled fires. Those methods that target saving homes are particularly popular, with 89% of Oregonians supporting clearing space around homes and 85% supporting preparing homes to be more fire resistant. In 2020, wildfires burned about 4,000 homes. As part of a sweeping wildfire preparedness package, lawmakers created a new mapping process to identify what homes are most at risk. About 120,000 property owners could be labeled as having higher extreme risk fire or higher extreme fire risk and may need to comply with coming requirements to safeguard their homes. There is state money to help them do so. So it's an important article because if you're in Oregon, you've noticed that summer basically didn't start till last week for some reason. It has rained all throughout the spring. We finally got sun, but that means the wildfires are still coming. Wildfire season is still coming. We're probably not going to get that much of this nice, like 70, 80 degree weather before it starts getting bad. So get prepared. But also, it's important for the state, the people who are, you know, supposed to take care of these emergencies, to be prepared on our behalf. So we'll keep an eye on that. Next story comes from Willamette Week, Nigel Jacquees, titled "The Latinx Advocacy Group CASA Abruptly Announces Closure." So according to Jacquees, founded in 1995 to advocate for Latinx immigrants, CASA won big victories in recent years. The biggest might have been a law passed in 2019 that gave undocumented immigrants the right to driver's licenses. That win came after a decade-long battle. CASA also worked across the state to cement 17 sanctuary city agreements in 2017 and in 2018, helped defeat ballot measure 105, which would have abolished the state's sanctuary law. In its most recent tax return filed in July 2020 for the 2019 tax year, the nonprofit reported revenues of just under $1.2 million and an operating surplus of $54,000. It also held $550,000 in net assets in the form of cash and savings accounts. It's unknown how much CASA's financial condition deteriorated since then, but the board said it would spend down the organization's remaining reserves on severance for employees. CASA's website showed a staff of 11 as of today and will grant anything left over to partner organizations. Also, according to Jacquees, in addition to the challenges of the pandemic, the board cited another reason for CASA's closure, labor problems, which is notable given the organization got its start in part by advocating for farm workers. Communications Workers of America Local 7901 organized CASA workers in March 2020. The newly formed union and management have been at a stalemate ever since. In an open letter last fall seeking public support, the CASA union accused management of, quote, union-busting tactics and reported it had filed an unfair labor practices complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. So I picked out this story because we often talk about the nonprofit industrial complex in Oregon, and a lot of times what we take for granted is the nuts and bolts of this work. And there's a lot of organizations that are, you know, they're not hey, we're close to multiple decades of work, but when it comes to hiring in between, when it comes to our labor practices, when it comes down to the cost of doing this work that is very important, it is more than just having a good idea and having some dedicated people. And I think a story like this, when you talk about an immigration organization that has had major victories, has been here since 1995, and it was not immune to the things that can often take these organizations down. So when we're doing this work, when we're doing this organizing work, it is important, it's essential really to, again, it's not just the spirit of the work, but also having those nuts and bolts, those details, having everything together to keep things sustainable. So our next story comes from Street Roots and is titled, "Police No Arrests Won't Fix Homelessness, They Keep Arresting People Anyway," by Melissa Lewis. Lewis writes, "Over the last decade, rent grew twice as fast in Portland as the rest of the country, and the estimated number of people experiencing homelessness increased by nearly 30%. Arrest data from Portland and five other major cities shows that the neighborhood outcry is fueling the vast criminalization of the homeless for largely nonviolent violations. According to an analysis by Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, it's a phenomenon that is generating unaffordable fines for unhoused individuals, sapping police resources, and failing to address the core problems fueling homelessness." A couple of big takeaways from the analysis were, quote, "The unhoused are disproportionately arrested, but these arrests are less likely to be for serious crime. Although the homeless population in all cities reviewed was less than 2% of the overall population, they accounted for anywhere from 7% of arrests in Oakland, California, to about half of all arrests in Portland. Unhoused people were less likely to be arrested for violent charges than housed people in every city Reveal examined." The study also found, quote, "that unhoused often are in connection with old offenses. Some of the most common offenses reflected particular challenges for someone living outside, failing to appear for court dates and keeping up with the terms of their probation or parole. In more than 40% of the arrests of unhoused people in Portland, the only purpose was to execute a warrant, most often for failing to show up for a court hearing. Unhoused people and their advocates say it's harder for them to get to court dates, and unaffordable penalties just perpetuate the cycle." Lewis also makes a note to talk about alternatives to policing. And she writes, "Some cities are developing alternatives. In 1989, Eugene, Oregon launched what has become the model for alternatives to policing unhoused people, CAHOOTS, which stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. The program sends an EMT and a mental health counselor instead of police and began responding 24 hours a day in 2017. In 2019, CAHOOTS responded to 20% of 911 calls in Eugene and Springfield, Oregon, saving the cities an estimated $15 million. And then this also, Lewis also brings us back to Street Response, which was started more recently, or Portland Street Response, which was more recently started in this city. And she writes, "The pilot program started with $1.08 million budget and limited personnel and hours. The program reduced police response to non-emergency welfare checks and dispatches coded as unwanted or suspicious persons, the types that represent the majority of homeless-related calls that police respond to, by 27% in its first year, according to new research from Portland State University. Researchers also estimated that if the program had been operating 24 hours a day and citywide, it would have responded to about half of the average 30,000 homeless-related calls for service each year. The City Council voted unanimously this year to expand the program citywide and to approve a budget of $11.5 million across 2 years. The funding comes from a combination of existing general funds, recreational cannabis tax revenue, and revenues from the 2021 American Rescue Plan." So this article just illustrates again how homelessness is criminalized in a variety of ways, most notably here with fines and just penalties that people can't afford to pay for, that are, you know, especially cumbersome when you're dealing with everything else you're dealing with when you're unhoused. So it's like a tax on a situation, a very hard situation to begin with. And It helps, again, helps fuel incarceration, mass incarceration, helps fuel the prison industrial complex, helps exacerbate this crisis we're already living under. And while some people are proposing, you know, more police to add to the problem, I think it's pretty clear from the data that's not it. So, again, we'll keep our eye on the expansion of Portland Street Response and hopefully the expansion of programs like it into throughout Oregon and other neighboring areas, because there's a lot of people out here, you know, dealing with these issues and dealing with, you know, calls where in other cases if they could trust that the police weren't going to come and kill somebody, they might call somebody, but instead you have problems that, again, are just getting exacerbated. Our final story comes from Portland Mercury. It's titled, "Portland Remains Out of Compliance with DOJ Settlement" by Alex Zielinski. And Zielinski writes, of the seven, this is for the Portland police specifically, she writes, of the seven sections outlined in the settlement agreement, the DOJ found the city to be out of compliance with six. And this comes from a 2014 settlement that, let me just give a little bit more background on it. Zielinski writes, it's been 16 months since the city of Portland first fell out of compliance with a settlement agreement it made with the U.S. Department of Justice regarding police use of force against people with mental illness. Yet the city is still a long way from again meeting the requirements laid out in the initial 2014 agreement, according to a report filed by DOJ attorneys Thursday. The report points to continued problems with Portland Police Bureau adequately reporting and investigating incidents when officers use force against a member of the public, an issue that pushed the city out of compliance in 2021. In January 2020, the DOJ made a long-awaited announcement that the city had officially met all the terms of the settlement agreement. That meant that if the city could remain in compliance for just one more year, it could finally be released from the one onerous legal agreement with the DOJ. But the heavy-handed police response to the racial justice protests of 2020 scuttled this plan. DOJ lawyers found that the PPB had been following protocols to keep track of each use of force incident, or hadn't been following protocols to keep track of each use of force incident against protesters and investigate actions that went against PPB's own policy. The report also notes that PPB's officer training isn't in alignment with the type of training agreed upon in the settlement. The attorneys specifically point to flaws in the training presentations for PPB's rapid response team, which was disclosed to the public in January 2022. That presentation included an offensive meme mocking protesters and what the DOJ determines to be inaccurate information on the, quote, legal justification of force, unquote, against protesters. The report adds that PPB did little to remedy the impact that this offensive presentation had on public's perception of its police or internal morale, let alone hold a new training for officers with a more appropriate presentation. Zielinski also writes, notably, the report finds that the PPB has a, quote, fundamental issue of accountability, unquote, regarding officer misconduct. This is reflected in the way PPB officers did not hold officers accountable for inappropriate uses of force during the 2020 protests, the DOJ attorney writes, instead blaming all problems on members of the public. So, if you were involved or knew people who were involved with the protests in 2020, this is probably not news to you. The PPB has accountability issues, has massive use of force issues. Its training program is messed up. But I do find it interesting that, according to this agreement, when they finally came in compliance 6 years later, all they needed to do was just be on their P's and Q's for 1 year, just good behavior for 1 year. And then people were like, Black Lives Matter, and that threw everything out. Just... It was too much. People like, say his name, George Floyd, and the police, you know, again, could not, in just the one year, everyone putting out, including, I'm sure, the police department, putting out their Black Lives Matter statements and their diversity statements, but when it came to simply just not beating the crap out of people, and not taking accountability for it or holding your police officers accountable. Couldn't do it. So here we go again, and as the story kind of alludes to, I don't have any expectations of the PPB taking any accountability after this. I don't have any expectations of them going the other way. I hope I'm wrong, but again, and I'll keep saying on the show, defund the police. Put in, you know, put money towards community. Invest in alternative solutions, because clearly this isn't working. And that's the news. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/brucepoinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer, but will I defend the prequels? Yes. If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/brucepoinsett. Hey, welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. We do this B block, and you know, as you might be aware, we're kind of a fan of, you know, the nerd culture things.
Very true.
And right now we're living in a time of the streaming services. We've got almost, it feels like an oversaturation of shows now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even going to say an oversaturation necessarily, because some people I've talked to are like, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed, you know. Miss Marvel and Obi-Wan come out on the same day. What am I going to do? Now me, I used to be an avid watcher of the CW or the Arrowverse.
As
which means they had, at one point, what was it like? You had like Black Lightning, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, The Flash, Arrow, all on the same week.
Yes.
Like
some on the same day as well.
Yeah, because like, I feel like at first they tried to spread it out over the different days, and it was like 5 days a week, and then they bunched them up into three. I don't know what they do now, but all I know is that you had like 5 hours of not great TV, but it had its moments.
Yeah.
And there was a while where I was really committed. So when people are like, oh my goodness, you have two, maybe even three shows if you're watching different services coming out in a week, it's manageable.
It's manageable, especially in you saying this and me knowing the topic that we're going to break into. I think the Arrowverse was a really good opening point, because nonetheless, the quality right now is unmatched.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is like the topic has been not just the oversaturation, but is it hurting the quality of the shows? And I feel like we're both kind of in some agreement that it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have certain shows like, you know, The Boys, mm-hmm. or, you know, Harley Quinn, or even now, like I think Miss Marvel most recently, where they're pretty much like more or less like universally lauded.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing great things. But then you also have, and again, my apologies to Ambush, because I didn't mean for it to break out this way, but a lot of DC shows go ahead.
Very specifically, because DC, like Peacemaker was great.
True.
Obviously, true. We said Harley Quinn.
You know, there are others, for example, Titans, where it's like I watch Titans religiously. Don't get me wrong.
Yes.
But, you know, it starts, season three started out very strong, and then, you know, and then the series that really will, might get me, this commentary might get me banned from the studio, but we're going to go with it anyway. I have an affinity for Young Justice, but it's come to the point, we got to talk about the writing. We have to.
Sorry, Ambush. No, it's better. I understand. Okay.
Like, you know, the first, like, when I first started watching Young Justice however many years ago, and I caught up late, like a lot of people, it's like, oh my God, this is, you know, this is amazing. And it was like an extension of, you know, was it Justice League Unlimited? And sort of like the last, for those who aren't familiar with Dwayne McDuffie, who was like the architect behind
the early DC like animated universe.
Yeah, and even before that with a Milestone Comics, specifically like, you know, comic book characters, not just comic book characters of color, but like, you know, iconic people like
Static.
Exactly, like Static, like
Icon, Rocket.
Icon, Rocket. So, and just like really, you know, not just putting these characters out there, because it wasn't just like some, oh, we're, you know, swapping Superman for a black person. Like, for example, like Icon, because that was like the Superman kind of like character. But, you know, with Icon, it was this alien that came through, landed during slavery, and the first person he saw was an enslaved black man. So that was the form he took.
Yes.
And then he came into the present and met Rocket, who, you know, it's like the master of this technology, but then was also like, you know, had this extended teen pregnancy storyline, and they were able to like delve into a lot of things about like just culture and depth of story that people weren't doing. And then, like I said, he ended up, like you said, he took that to early DC, like late 90s TV, and then really blew it up with Justice League Unlimited, where it wasn't just like the Justice League, but also these characters from Milestone, and just like expanded the universe, diversified the universe. And again, the way he wrote and the way like he influenced others around him to write, there was a level of depth in covering stuff beyond just the regular superhero fare, like covering culture, covering, you know, socioeconomics and stuff. They did it in a way that was both like kind of subtle, like, it, but it also got the point across, and it was like, it's just great storytelling.
Yes.
And I forget off the top of my head which year Dwayne McDuffie passed.
As do I.
But, you know, he passed unexpectedly, and I want to say like, that'd be like around like 2010.
Yeah, I would say around the time Young Justice was coming out is when he passed. I remember seeing a lot about that.
Exactly. But, you know, when Young Justice did come out, like, you could definitely still feel that. It kept expanding the universe, and it still had that depth. Like,
yes,
you know, just, like, I loved it. But, like, when you first saw Young Justice, like, what were your thoughts when you first, you know, got that experience?
I was a very early watcher. Like, I remember the premiere, the release, I remember the exact block. Like, this is a very... Young Justice is, like, my favorite television show. Like, the first two seasons, to me, are like perfect superhero television. I think because I was the target audience when it came out as well, it was kind of life-changing, because we were talking about the episode where they do the mission like in the brain where like everything is fake and then all of them die. And then the next episode is an episode where they go to therapy with Black Canary. And they get to talk about their experience and being a young teen superhero. And at the time, like, that had never been done. Like, Teen Titans was a really good series that told really fun and serious stories. Mm-hmm. But Young Justice was the first time that we'd ever seen teen superheroes looked at as serious as we had seen the adult superheroes looked at.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I came on to... or Young Justice much later, like when it was on Netflix. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was hooked.
Yes.
And I can't remember if I watched Young Justice before I watched Justice League Unlimited or not. But either way, it was just like, I know they just like fit into each other so well. And like, like you said, like just the way they handled it with that maturity of the storytelling was just something I was not seeing anywhere else. And it was so refreshing. So now that we have,
we love this show. We love Young Justice. I feel like we have to preface.
That's very,
this is a love letter.
Very important. We love Young Justice. We want to see the best for it.
Mm-hmm.
We gotta talk about,
the relaunch.
Yeah. You know, back, I started with the DC app.
The DC app, yeah.
DC Universe, whatever it's called now. It's all on HBO Max.
Yes.
And you can,
Tell.
You can tell we've gotten further away from the McDuffie era in a big way because, like, they're, give them credit. They're trying to handle, you know, more mature, more full subjects, but it is. It's heavy, heavy, heavy-handed.
Heavy-handed.
Again, you know me.
Yes.
I love the deep stuff. I love the politics, but
mm-hmm.
like when it's not natural, it feels weird to watch.
It was, I think even look at some of the character, like, here's the thing. I feel like a lot of times as well, there are people who will say like, certain things come off as heavy-handed when they're not. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the cases where, like, even I look at how they told the story of Miss Martian throughout the first two seasons and how it was, like, almost dealing with the topic of race in such an interesting way. Because, like, if you look at it, Miss Martian was a character who was a minority on her planet and then came to our planet, got to choose what she wanted to be, and chose to be white. Mm. And that's a lot to unpack. Like, that's a really crazy story. But they didn't like, they weren't like, yes, when I came to Earth, I wanted to be a white woman so I can experience life on the other side. It was just like, that's just what she did. Exactly. While with the new series, I feel like they explain all of the moments that have to do with any type of social commentary very clearly.
Yeah, you know, in writing the concept, so, you know, you're supposed to show, not tell.
Yes.
And they do a lot
so much of telling.
And so they do that. And then my third big
gripe.
Yeah. With the writing is just that they have a character Forager who,
yes,
you know, talks, you know, in the third person, but then also, I guess, like, their species, like, they're all Forager and not like mini Forager, green Forager. It's just like Forager.
They're just all Forager.
They're all Foragers. So they had two Forager characters. And so you get dialogue at some point where it's like 3 minutes of Forager. Is Forager foraging? Forager. It's just like, so in addition to the heavy-handed writing in some places,
mm-hmm.
the weird poetry slam end credits, and then just padding out episodes with long, extra long Forager, mm-hmm. foraging, Forager. It's just like, I want this, again, emphasize again, we love Young Justice. We love
this show.
We want this to do well,
mm-hmm.
but my goodness.
It is rough.
We gotta, come on.
Take your time. Like, next season, give us, just take some time, take some breathing room, get back to the roots, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a series writer. I would love to be. Trust me, if you want to hire me for Young Justice, let me know. Yeah. But just take some time and go back to character writing, less dealing with issues in superhero writing, if that makes sense.
Even if you want to deal with issues, just write it better.
Just write it better.
Like, make it a little action based.
Yes.
Weave it into, like, don't sit people down at the table.
Weave it into the story.
To talk about this thing in the most, you know, explaining the ABCs to a wide audience. We don't need that. Give us, you know, you've got characters. You've got Rocket.
Mm-hmm.
Got Static.
Yes.
You can
Blue Beetle.
You
Halo.
Can, You can get into so much with just going through their lives and, you know, also, again, spending a little bit less time on white teen melodrama. Just, just going to throw that out there.
Yes.
If I don't hear McGann recite poetry again, I'll be all right. Really
can
will.
Can we just go back? I'm just serious. Like, Young Justice was the name, and all of our original team are adults. And I don't think fans would be mad if we were willing to just move on to the next generation.
Amen. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. I have a special guest with me today, co-founder and executive director of Equitable Giving Circle, AJ McCreary.
Hi.
Hi, AJ.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. How are you doing today?
Good. Glad it's Thursday. Thursday, right.
So, you know, for those who don't know AJ, but maybe if you've driven around Portland the last few months, you've most likely, even now it's a July. Yes, July. Yeah. We're there. You probably still see AJ McCreary for Portland signs. Like, obviously, I know it's not the most fun subject to bring up because the city council race didn't go as obviously you would have liked. But I think it's safe to say you made a pretty positive impact on the race, on the city. And I know just for me personally, like, you really made an impression on me in terms of just like, I think you have a real talent for like communicating the nuts and bolts of politics that's needed. Not just like where we need to go with a lot of like progressive issues, but also like how to actually get there. And I think it's just it's a much needed thing. You know, from our talks before, obviously I've tried to kind of like nudge you a little bit to be like, ooh, can we get like an AJ's Corner segment? And, you know, I promise I'll try, as I just did it again, I promise I'll try not to as much, but...
No, I will say, just like the city council race, I always do actually appreciate those professional nudges to like, stretch or try something different. I don't know if I can commit in this moment to that, but I do appreciate, like, the opportunity to come in and talk, and the compliment, like, about my voice and my understanding of knowing politics and, like, to break it down.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think this is a great time to talk because we're heading into, you know, nationally heading into the midterms. And there's a lot of people who are very, very disillusioned, very, you know, I think rightfully cynical about the state of politics, especially on the left right now. And, you know, wondering, especially like, why should I vote? Like, Joe Biden is just...
Joe Biden is terrible, so we'll just put that out there for everybody to know. He's not doing a great job. I don't think anyone's surprised, though. And we do have to vote.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
If you just had, like, a message for people who are kind of in that cynicism right now, like, is there something you might want to impart just to get people, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that I would say. One, we do have a democracy. Let's participate in it. Like, it's critical that we participate in it. Even if we don't believe in the system and we don't agree, we do have to participate. We cannot change anything with just protesting in the street or not participating. Like, a protest vote does nothing except pushes us further into things that we don't agree with. Here in Portland and Oregon, it's not very much effort to vote. Ballots come to our house. You can do your voting literally anywhere in your bed while eating, while watching a silly movie. You could take it very seriously. The option is yours, but you can do it at the privacy of your home. You can do it on the go in your car. And then you can even just have your mail person pick it up or drop it off at a ballot box or at the ballot office. So we have a lot of options and ease in that way. So here in Portland, in this very liberal place, there's no excuse for us not to be voting. And more importantly, I would say anybody that thinks that they are their ancestors' wildest dream, that thinks that they are really being, you know, a part of this liberation work, our ancestors fought very, very hard for the right to vote. If you're a Black or Brown person, if you are an immigrant or second generation, if you are a woman, our rights to vote are new, they're fresh. Use that right. It's really critical. And it's irresponsible. Like when people are like, I'm not going to vote because blah, blah, blah. I don't believe in the system. I don't believe in the system. And I ran for public office. Mm-hmm. I will vote because I know that all of my ancestors did not have the opportunity, the luxury, or the privilege to vote. And I am doing them a disservice in all of their work, their legacy, and their intentions if I don't vote. And like all of my Black ancestors, all of my Indigenous ancestors, all of my women ancestors, it is my responsibility to them to vote. So I don't believe in the system, probably as much as many people who are listening to this also don't believe in the system, but we can't change it by a protest vote or not participating in Portland and in Oregon. It takes no effort to vote. And we're a millennial city. We could show up and show out and like change the whole game. I'd also say that like we will not get interesting, capable, different candidates to show up and show out if we are too lazy as a population to vote for them. Because I was not the first younger, progressive, you know, out of the box, non-career politician person to run for public office in Portland. I won't be the last. I am not special in that way. There's nothing about me in that way that's special. And yes, 45,000 people showed up. It's like, you know, it was like a third, 30% of the vote. But how are you going to attract more people to come and do this work and like running the campaign? You don't get paid for that. So it's like a very, very full time, you know, months worth of labor. We're going to have a hard time attracting more people if we are too lazy to show up. In just Portland's primaries, 220,000 people showed up to vote. And this is important. There's 800,000 people in Portland, 550,000 people registered to vote, and 220,000 people showed up. About 50,000 people of that did vote in that race did not vote in my race, so they downvoted. Mm-hmm. If they had voted or been like, let me just vote on new, vote on somebody different, I would have went to the primary or get to the, I would have went to the general election and we would see something different. I don't think that people are understanding these nuances in this space. And this is really important to understand. Primaries do really dictate who is in that, the general election, and midterm elections are critical. A lot of things sneak through during midterm elections. And so this isn't even about me, because like, I am glad that like, I am not personally going to be responsible to clean up this housing issue that the boomers have totally. This is all boomer policy. When you go outside and you see these things that are not working, whether it's schools, housing issues, mental health issues, lack of services, food insecurities, on and on and on, even our public transit going to shit. This is all boomer policy. Boomers have been in charge for 40 something years and poorly, just poorly. And if you're offended by that, good job. Congratulations. Hold that dear. Maybe ponder why you're offended and maybe do better, be better. But I'm glad I'm not responsible for that. Like, cause it's overwhelming. Like what that generation has done, but also like we have to show up and it's going to be a big, you know, like this election is going to really, really dictate the future of the United States. Like I said that midway through my race, very much like we are really going to see where America is at. We're really going to see where Portland is at by who we vote for, what's happening, who shows up and how we show up. And we're going to see that even more so in November. And I think it's really important for younger folks, particularly millennials, to start getting involved. I know that we as a generation, we are not, as many of us are not as parents as maybe we all want to be. We are not homeowners. We are not property owners at all. We might have a fancy title without necessarily the resources that come with it. Like, these are things that our generation is actively experiencing. And the ways that we change it is start showing up as a collective and voting these motherfuckers out.
To that end, though, because, you know, like I said, you're running for office for the first time. And, you know, I've been aware of Equitable Giving Circle for a little bit. But, you know, like I said, your campaign was really the opportunity. And specifically, I want to shout out Amber Boydston, because we did an event. That's kind of where I met you at.
Mm-hmm. But, Amber's amazing. If you don't know about Spirit of Justice and the work that they're doing, please check them out. They are a really amazing abolitionist group that does a lot of immediate direct care for folks, especially folks in active crisis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, but I found out it's like, you know, I kind of, there's like a degree of separation because, and I'm wondering if people tell you this all the time, like, oh, you're Hobbs' mom?
I'm Hobbs' mom.
Because, you know, for those who don't know Hobbs, like this, you know, young prodigy.
He's a ballet dancer, a visual artist, an activist, a young philanthropist. Well, he's not necessarily using his own dollars. He works for a philanthropy company doing development. He's in his second year of college, or second semester at community, at Mount Hood Community College. He's 15. He's pretty amazing.
No big deal.
15. He is a big deal. It's weird.
I remember seeing, I think, some of his artwork for another person, shout out Mr. Bobby Fowler, one of his exhibits, like, years ago. And my roommate also is in, like, sort of, like, a dance teaching world, so they knew about Hobbs a little bit, too. So, yeah, when I made that connection, it's like, oh, wow. But that, this makes sense.
Hobbs is.
So, you do get recognized probably as Hobbs' mom more, but...
Yeah, it's interesting because people at this point either know me like Hobbs' mom, mutual aid, or activism. And I feel like in a lot of ways, like people, they're often surprised. They're like, wait, oh, you guys are connected? Or they know me through EGC. And then there's people that just know me like because I grew up in Portland. And there's that, like being a long time forever resident. I have left and come back.
We're going to get back to that, specifically some of the lessons you've taken from other places. But let's talk about Equitable Giving Circle for a little bit. Can you talk, when did the group start?
We officially started conversing in December of 2019. I had participated in a different giving circle in town that just really didn't resonate with my soul. It was just sort of like white lady. And it wasn't an equitable thing. And it wasn't something, there was like a lot of hoopla. Like, I love the concept of what they were talking about. But it just didn't like translate into real life or an experience. And I was like, I'm just not rocking with this. And I was in a different space that we were talking about racism. And I was like, if y'all going to subject me to like having this strange, unorganized kumbaya foolery, let's actually like do something with this energy. Let's go somewhere with it. So we originally were talking about creating a giving circle that hyper-focused around Black and brown women and femmes in business and doing like business showers, little cash grants, kind of just like ways that we can be supportive because this was a collective of women and femmes in business. And then, so we were chatting about that for a couple months and trying to get this together. What would this look like? What would it feel like? Blah, blah, blah. And then the pandemic had happened. And I had just been at an event called the Black Growers Gathering and was very inspired by meeting all of these Black and brown farmers and food purveyors because farmers are really amazing people. Like, they know lots of things. They're very generous. They're just, I don't know, being around farmers is just kind of like reminds me of being a kid at a, you know, like a field trip. It's just like, oh, I'm going to learn something. You might get a good snack. So I was like, y'all, business, all these things happening. The pandemic was just about to like pop off. And I proposed to our group, well, let's put this on hold. Let's buy CSA boxes from Black and brown farmers and give them away to Black and brown families who are going to feel this pandemic really hard because the group is also, a lot of us are moms or caregivers of some kind. And so it was like, we were all very much as business-minded people seeing what is about to happen. Group loved the idea. And we did all the things to launch a fundraiser, and we were going to support 50 families through the summer with summer CSA boxes. And in a week of launching our fundraiser, we'd raised over, it was like $35,000. And people just loved this idea. And being the person I am, and I'm not allowed to go to Vegas, because I was like, let's double down. Let's do 100 boxes. It'll be great. It'll be... And it was. We easily covered the funds to do 100 boxes for the summer for families. And then from there, it just kind of grew. We got an opportunity to get $350,000 from the city. And then it was just like, it just kind of spiraled. And our goals of supporting just women and femmes in business really changed. So now we're feeding Black and Brown families. We feed about a little over 300 through our home delivery. And then also we have a weekly pantry. So today our pantry is happening at Alder Commons. It goes from 10 to 2 every day. So I guess it's about wrapping up right now. But so we just, kind of really got into the weeds doing that food justice work. We work intentionally with Black and Brown business owners. So we buy from Black and Brown farmers, but like our insurance agent is a Black woman. We have two insurance agents. Both of them are Black. We're intentionally working with Black and Brown folks and other professional spaces that we need to spend money. Very intentional in that way. So still like at the core doing what we set out to do, but it has taken a different shift. We have a housing program that we're looking for more dollars for. We've put about $200,000 into the community in 3-month rent and mortgage relief grants. And then we also host community events. We have a monthly lunch and learn, a monthly happy hour conversation. And then I host, not every month, but fairly regularly, probably going to like break it down to quarterly, just a conversation about money and economics and what EGC is doing with our money. And then we have large community events. So like this season, we've all just kind of like need a little bit of space because we've done so much the last 2 years. But we had a big Mother's Day event, which is like turn into an annual thing. We'll have a large back to school event in August. So we have 3 branches: community wellness, food justice, and housing. And it has grown. We've raised over $5 million in cash and in-kind donations. During the last 5 years, we have served over 25,000 people. In part of our community wellness, inspired by the underground plant trade, we collect plants and give them away to Black and Brown people. So that's one of the ways we've served so many people, and people have interacted with us. And at the core of what we do, we are all about like having the best for our community. Black and Brown people have been forced to take sort of leftovers or scraps. If you are not aware of the experience people had in chattel slavery, when white people enslaved Black folks as property, part of that experience for people that were enslaved was getting leftovers, getting scraps. And that is a legacy that has carried on through charity work or nonprofit work. And EGC is not about that. So we don't do any expired things. We really do believe in the best. The plants have been a really great way to help like teach people about that like conversation, and really kind of teach the experience of sharing and sharing nice things. And I guess we're kind of like the bougie nonprofit of Portland. And I love that because, you know, I worked in boutiques for a long time. I like fancy things at, you know, use prices for me personally. And I want our community to always be reminded that they are valuable and deserve nice things.
Yeah. When you talk about sort of like this idea that kind of carried over from slavery, or specifically around just normalizing us taking scraps and everything, I think, you know, there's a lot of pervasive myths around fundraising, especially out here in Portland metro area, because so many people are involved in the, you know, nonprofit industrial complex, but not necessarily, you know, people get into this work. Well, a lot of people, maybe not all, maybe not most, but a lot of people get into this work as just, you know, like a grassroots thing or something that just kind of like started on like a shoestring level. But, you know, there's certain like experiences, whether it be accounting, or, you know, like career development, you know, personnel management. Like, these are like real skills that people, you know, go to school for, that people are, you know, apprentice under other people for, that, you know, we don't, again, because people are working kind of like on the shoestring level, that, you know, they have to either learn later or don't learn, or learn the hard way. Mm-hmm. So I want to just ask you, you know, what are some of the, you know, most pervasive myths around fundraising that you run into? Or actually, let me ask you before we get into like some other ones. Like, I feel like people don't understand how much money is really out there. Not to answer my own question, but you up with that one.
People are very unaware of how much money is out there and that people want to give. We are all trained, whether it was very intentional or just subconsciously have been trained in a scarcity mentality, so that there's not enough resources and that everybody is going to be stingy. Yes, those people exist, unfortunately, but there's lots of generous people that do want to be a part of the solutions and that do want to give. And there's lots of money that goes untapped. I will, like, scholarships is one. There's a lot of money that is like slated for Black or Brown students. And then often if they don't apply, then like white kids end up getting the opportunity, or that scholarship money will just go back in the pot. That happens with like city, state, and federal grants. It happens with, foundations. And then there's also private philanthropy. I think also there is tons of regular people that are not rich by any means that are open and willing to share, even if it's small amounts. And it's just part of like being able to ask and talk about it. We are not in a society that's like comfortable or used to talking about money, like how much I make, how much I donated, how much my rent is, whatever, whatever. And I think that's kind of part of the problem. Like, we have to break down those money wounds. And that's all by design. Capitalism wants us to not talk about our money, to be really funny about it, and to, you know, like, this is a taboo conversation. It's not. This is a resource. And like, we have different resources. But because of that culture of not talking about money and, you know, just having all of this, these walls up around it, it makes it really complex. It's also that we're not used to, you know, being able to comfortable with like no or yes ands, or we exist in this world where everything has to be black or white, right? It has to be this way or that way. In fundraising, you're going to hear lots of no's, or circle back, or what about this, or I can do this, or maybe let me introduce you to somebody. I use my fundraiser that my son had. He is a classically trained ballet dancer, and it is very expensive. And as a single parent, I have never had the full funds to, you know, fund his dream. And luckily we've had amazing community members, people that we know and don't know. I was just talking to one of my mentors about one of his biggest, my kid's biggest donors is somebody named Cable that I've never met. I've never even been on a phone with this person. I've had maybe like two email conversations, and they have donated significant amount of dollars. When kid got a scholarship to the San Francisco Ballet Summer Intensive, which, yes, the scholarship part was amazing, but we had to get there. We had to be able to eat for 3.5 weeks. It means I'm not working for 3.5 weeks. He was also, what, like 13 when we went? We had to stay in downtown San Francisco. I don't drive, so it's not like I could also, like, we could be somewhere else. And then, like, so this is a very expensive trip. This is a person who never even met my kid, who's just like, I really love what this kid's doing, and I'm going to make a donation. And talking to my mentor about it, and she was just like, I think that happens more often than not. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. Like, if you are really passionate about what you're doing, and, like, there are strangers that want to help you. There are people that will go above and beyond. And I mean, for me, that was, like, such a transformational experience. Like, this, the reason I ended up talking to this individual is because in San Francisco, they don't have fresh orange juice for whatever fucking reason. And they don't. Like, this was like a whole joke while we were there. And I complained to a friend of mine who knows this person. And then this person emailed me, was like, are y'all, do you need more money? Because I was like, why is orange juice non-existent and so expensive here? And it was just like this very interesting, like, wow, there's so many resources and people that care. And because people understand, like, I want to help fund this new idea or this other, this artist, or I want somebody to have an opportunity that I didn't have. So I think like we have to really, and I love reflecting on that, like this individual that I always remember, I kind of don't ever want to meet them either, right? Like that's part of the magic is that it would be cool to like run into them organically or something. I know what they look like based off of their Twitter picture. But like it, I think it's like, for me, it's just like such a, wow, there is this way that people care and want to show up and support. And I mean, this is a Black man who now has resources and literally is the very little that I know is that this is because he didn't have somebody who just invested in him blindly. And that's really powerful. And that's like goes for anything.
Hey, y'all. Sorry for the 8-0 interruption here. I just need to give y'all the info that this week we are cutting the interview into two pieces with AJ. So obviously you saw the first half, and then in the next 2 weeks, in the next episode, you'll be able to see the rest of the interview. Hopefully y'all enjoyed that interview, and we will do outros and stuff. Yeah.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, Black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.